Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kellen McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Ur Umit Ungor to the show. Ur is an associate professor of history at the University of Utrecht and the editor of an interesting new collection of essays titled Genocide, New Perspectives on Its Causes, Courses, and Consequences. The book is actually somewhat unique. It's a compilation of essays written by graduates of the master's program in Holocaust Genocide Studies at NIOD, and I'll give Ur a chance to talk a little bit about what that is in a moment, which is offered through the University of Amsterdam. And it is more or less the best of the best from that program. And it's really good. The essays cover a wide variety of topics and regions. And read together, it really gives a fascinating window into the state of genocide research in now 2016, the year it's published. And so I'm greatly looking forward to talking with Ur about it. And so with that, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thanks for having me.
So I always start by asking our guests to say something about their background. And so, Ur, maybe you could talk just a little bit about how you came to be a historian and how you came to be interested in the field of genocide studies.
Yeah, well, thank you, Kelly, for having me. It's a great pleasure and great honor to be on the New Books in Genocide Studies. I'm also very pleased that this book, gets some exposure because I think that it deserves it. And I mm-hmm. also think that the contributions and the authors and also the program in Amsterdam deserves the exposure and the attention. Now, I named this for a reason because when I got interested in mass violence and genocide, it's a very difficult question to answer always. There's a new book, a different new book out by Samuel Totten about scholars mm-hmm. of genocide, in which different genocide scholars or experts explain in a very personal essay what brought them to the subject. And when I was writing that, I was thinking, it's actually a very difficult question. I don't think I can pinpoint one moment, one epiphany that I had, but it became an accumulative process. And I think one of the issues was, of course, I grew up in the Netherlands, and I grew up in the 1980s. I went to primary school. 1990s, I went to high school. And the Second World War and the Holocaust always loomed large in schools. So it was an important part of the curriculum. I used to go to the library and read war novels. And these war novels, I found them rather eerie, to be honest. I found it almost unthinkable that such a peaceful society, the one that I was living in, 1980s, 1990s, Holland, had once been the scene of really unimaginable cruelty. Mm-hmm. And so I got more and more interested in that. And so I started reading a little bit more about the Holocaust, first journalistic books, and then gradually more academic books. And by the time that I was enrolled in university, I had a decent knowledge of the Second World War and the Holocaust. Now, when I started the university, I was not really interested that much in it. And I enrolled in a sociology program. Mm-hmm. And to be perfectly honest, the first year I just partied. I really didn't get any credits, to be honest. But after that, at some point, I had a bit of a small epiphany when, mm-hmm. In the summer of 2002, I remember that well, when I was in Turkey, because I was born in Turkey but raised in the Netherlands. When I was in Turkey, I was sitting in in my grandmother's living room, and she was preparing food in the living room. She was sitting on the floor, and I think she was cleaning onions. And there was a television program which featured a debate between, not really a debate, but a propaganda program, really, between two men, two historians, or pseudo-historians, who denied the Armenian genocide in very clear terms. This was on the Turkish state television. And I watched this program for a brief moment. And then I turned to my grandmother, and I said, "Grandma, what about the Armenians in our village, where we are from, in the eastern parts of Turkey? Were there any Armenians in our village?" And my grandma turned to me, and she said, "Of course there were Armenians in our village, and they were all killed by the government in the First World War. Didn't you know that?
Huh.
And it was such a bizarre moment when, on the one hand, on television you have men in suits pontificating about how the Armenians stabbed the Turks in the back and how there was never any genocide, and if there was a genocide, the Armenians committed it. So, you know, the usual refrain of the genocide denial, it was on television, propagated on state television. And on the other hand was my illiterate grandmother, who had very clear, very concrete post-memories of that genocide. And so that the paradox, it struck me so much that I thought, you know, I need to find out a little bit more about this. And so I started reading about the Armenian genocide, and I reached a state of shock. I was really abhorred by the levels of injustice and violence visited upon the Armenians. So that led to me enrolling in the master's program of Holocaust and Genocide Studies in Amsterdam, which was just established in 2003. And I graduated with a thesis, which was a regional study of the genocide in southeastern Turkey. And that grew into my PhD. In my PhD, I wrote a broader kind of contextual historical study about how the Republic of Turkey was established, and especially what forms of violence were utilized by the then Turkish government in establishing this homogeneous nation state. Part of it was the Armenian genocide, and there were also violence against the Kurds in the 1920s and 30s. And that kind of brought me to a postdoc, and then later I became an assistant professor, and this is where I am now.
And so I mentioned that this comes out of the master's program that's associated with NIAID and the University of Amsterdam. Can you tell us a little bit about NIAID and what it is and what it does?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the NIAID is, the Institute's acronym stands for Dutch Institute for War Documentation. And it was an institute that was established actually right at the end of the Second World War, on the 8th of May, 1945, to establish independent research on the history of the Second World War in the Netherlands, and the German occupation and the Holocaust and the problems of collaboration, Dutch collaboration with the Nazis. And it was an institute that produced, since the end of the war, an immense volume of research on these topics. So the definitive histories of that period of the Second World War, and even the war of decolonization right after, the canon was established then. Now, in the late 1990s, it became a part of the Royal Academy of Sciences, and in 2003, a separate institute was established, the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies, somewhat modeled after the existing ones in North America, which was an institute that had three tasks. One was research, academic research and publishing. The second one was higher education. So it set up an entire master's program, a one-year master's program in Holocaust and Genocide Studies at the University of Amsterdam. And the third pillar was public outreach, so facilitating and furthering public discussion on Holocaust and genocide and mass atrocities. And it's there where I really kind of where I grew into the academic that I was, but I wasn't the only one. In the beginning, let's say in the first year, there were maybe three students. There were three enrollments, and the professors were panicking, thinking, "Oh my God, you know, if we don't get enough students, then they might shut us down." And then now, actually, if you look at the if you speak with the current coordinators of the program, the director of graduate research, they get about 100 applications now from all over the world, actually, from Latin America, from Indonesia, from Turkey, from Europe, from North America, and we get 100 applications. Not all of them get through, of course, because we are selective, but certainly several dozens they get through, and it's a unique program that educates students within a year. Some of them take a little bit longer than a year to do field work or archival research. In that respect, it's a unique and a really, if you can say that, a beautiful program.
So some of it is clearly the quality of the program and just kind of getting off the ground and gaining visibility. Does the explosion in the number of people who are applying, does that say anything about the broader level of interest in Holocaust and genocide studies, or do you think that's just the fact of the quality of the program?
Well, if I was the PR person at the university, I would say, of course, because of the quality of the program, there should be no doubt about it.
There
but
you go.
Of course, there are broader trends in the kind of global interest in genocide. So 2003, of course, we see the genocide in Darfur. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, we've seen much closer to Europe some very, very serious, very grave mass violence in Iraq, for example. Right now it's ongoing in Syria. And I think that for younger generations, and by younger I mean, let's say, people born after the 1990s, so after the Cold War, which is most of our students right now, most of our mm-hmm. MA students. Well, these kids, of course, very often they have a basic interest in the Holocaust. But what we see in these applications, and also in the evaluations, course evaluations, or the evaluations of the entire MA program, is that there's an interest to learn more about, say, non-Western genocides, to learn about other genocides than the Holocaust, and also how this relates to the Holocaust. And I think it's that the kind of global cosmopolitan interest in this attitude in a world that's becoming rapidly smaller, of course, because of social media and because of the internet. I think it's this trend among the younger generation that has bolstered this MA program. But of course, it's also very much about the quality of the program.
Well, and the quality is reflected in the students' work, which is really, I mean, I'm tempted to say startlingly good, and I shouldn't say that because all master's students work hard. But there are some really excellent essays in here, and we'll talk about some of them in a moment. But it does reflect the quality of the program. And I said a little bit about how this book came to be. Maybe you could say a little bit more about the genesis of the book and about what kind of criteria you used to pick the essays that are in the book.
Yeah. So the idea to launch this book is something that I was thinking about for in the years preceding the publication of the book. And I was kind of surprised or a little bit startled by the fact that a lot of MA students, whether they finish their MAs in 1 year or 2 years, whether they do a lot of primary research or not, mm-hmm. a lot of them, they write really good MA theses, actually.
Yeah.
And it can be like 20,000 words, 25,000 words, say, you know, and they write these theses, and then we just file them in the filing cabinet, and then the kids just run off, and then nothing happens with these theses.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, look, guys, I mean, you've done some really good research. Why don't you try to publish it as a journal article, for example, or...
Mm-hmm.
And so we just started stimulating them to condense their theses, to boil it down and to reduce it to, let's say, 25-page, 30-page article and send it into a journal, to a respectable journal, good peer-reviewed journal. And actually, many of them have gotten accepted mm-hmm. in pretty good journals. And so I thought, well, if that's really possible, if the quality is really up to par, then why don't we make an edited book to profile this master's program, and also the NIOT, the Institute for War, Holocaust, and Genocide Studies. So what I did is I approached certain unpublished graduates, people who had written excellent theses, but who were not necessarily interested in pursuing a publication. And mm-hmm. I asked them, would you be interested in contributing to this volume? And at first, some of them were a little bit skeptical, of course. As an MA student, you might not have the self-confidence that, you know, a lot of them thought, well, really, me? Can we really publish an MA mm-hmm. thesis? And I said, well, look, the research is actually very good, and it's for a reason that you received a very high mark, for example, a very high grade. So we approached some of the best, and they agreed. I was very happy that some of them also wanted to collaborate. There's one collaborative chapter in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And we put it together. We worked really hard on it. And so the introduction, and of course we structured the book as well, so not just a haphazard collection of chapters, mm-hmm. but we tried to structure it into the causes of genocide, the courses of genocide, and the consequences, so the before, during, and after. And so, together with a preface and an epilogue, we sent it in to a peer-reviewed university press, and they accepted it. Mm. And to be honest, I was not very surprised, because the contributions are really very good.
Yeah.
Well, that's how it came to me.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the book. And you start out your introduction with a personal story. And so I'd like to ask you to retell that personal story and ask you why you decided to start your essay that way.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. We are taught, generally, we teach our students, our undergraduate students, to always maintain a balance between personal involvement and academic detachment.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And a lot of students can come to think, well, you have to be objective, and fully detached, and never show any emotion when you deal with issues of violence, including genocide and Holocaust. And of course, that's very lofty. It's a very lofty principle, but the reality is we all live in societies, and we are some members of, we are citizens of states, or we are members of ethnic groups or nations that were involved in genocide, either as victims or as perpetrators. Or as eyewitnesses, indeed. And I think it would be. I started the book with a personal anecdote of one of my travels on the Syrian coast.
Mm-hmm.
This is an anecdote that I write in the introduction. I start with it like as a pitch for the book. And in the summer of 2006, I was traveling in Syria. This is, of course, before the uprising and before the war. And before all the bloodshed, and it was, you know, it was a tourist country, and of course it was a police state. We knew that, but still, it was cheap, and you had great food, and people were really friendly, and it was always sunny. So I traveled through this town on the coast. It was called Banyas, and it was a terribly peaceful place. And interacting with the Syrians, I found that actually there's so much harmony in this society, or there's very little friction. But of course, this was the, you know, still waters run deep. And I think what I had touched was I'd only scratched the surface and only superficially processed what was, a society with some very serious problems in its state, also in its inter-ethnic and inter-religious coexistence. And I was shocked when several years later, in 2013, in May 2013, some of the worst massacres of the civil war in Syria, they occurred in Banyas, in the very town where I had smoked a hookah, and where I had drank tea with friends. And everything was hunky-dory, really, on the beach that we used to hang out there. And then it turned into this wasteland. And I thought, wow, you know, these are the people I spoke to. These are the people I interacted with. I even saw their faces sometimes in my dreams. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be good not to start with a kind of bland theory or with a very abstract concept, but to start with a very personal idea. And to take the personal idea and then to inject it into the scholarship, and to ask the question, okay, what can we learn from this violence? And how does it relate to the broader field of genocide, of genocide studies?
And then you move on, after having kind of caught the audience's attention, and maybe given them a moral stake, to talk a little bit about, I don't know if you would call it a model or what, but something of a model for studying genocide, one that identifies three levels of action and highlights the temporal complexity of genocide. Can you maybe summarize the model for us briefly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so of course, as a sociologist, I do believe that models can be useful. I don't think we should reduce the complexity of the historical record and of the manifold ways that people interact with each other, and of contingency, which is very important. But I think that a model at a very basic level is a simplified reconstruction of events, or of a process. And so what I did with this model is something that I patched together from different studies of genocide, including the works of Jacques Semelin, for example, in his book Purify and Destroy, including Donald Bloxham's work on when he looks at the institutional collaboration in the States. You know, why do certain ministries and bureaucracies, why do they cooperate in genocide? So I look at basically three levels of analysis. This is an ecological model. The top level is the macro level. So I'm dealing really with the external relations of a state, the international relations, the foreign ministries, the diplomacies. So what happens in the external relations of a state that is involved in committing a genocide? Right. So how did, for example, Milosevic's Serbia, how did it relate to the region, to Europe, to the world in, let's say, 1994, at the same time that it was killing thousands of people in Bosnia and Croatia and, of course, later in Kosovo? This is fascinating to me. And, of course, this deals with issues of sovereignty. This deals with issues of humanitarian intervention. This also has, of course, also relates to regional alliances. And we've seen this now with Syria. It's fascinating to see the kind of the relationship between Russia, Iran, and the Assad regime in Syria, and how some regimes or governments that are involved in committing mass violence against civilians, how they can be backed, and how they can receive patronage from more powerful states, much like in Rwanda, for example. In the Rwandan genocide, you saw that with France. You saw that with Saddam Hussein's Iraq. You saw that with the United States or with some European states. And that's kind of an interesting phenomenon that hasn't really been studied that much.
Mm-hmm.
I think these kind of regimes, they can only commit this genocide because they feel backed by a very powerful, either regional or global player. And so the second level, so if we descend from that macro level, from the international level to the domestic level, I call this the meso level. The meso level deals with the domestic, the internal power struggles and conflicts of all developments that relate to the genesis of a political crisis and later a civil war or genocide, ultimately. So this is about the ideology, very important decision-making processes. This is still probably of all topics in genocide studies, if we break it all down, decision-making processes are absolutely fascinating to me.
Mm.
And one of the books that I read when I was still a graduate student was Christopher Browning's really thick, like 500-page book on the genesis of the final solution, in which he devotes several hundreds of pages to simply, I think it's 18 months of historical developments in Nazi Germany, when he zooms into the decision-making process. And then, of course, the emergence of perpetrator networks, and the process of the segregation and ultimately the annihilation of the victim group. So the internal developments, this is what interests me really the most. And then if we descend even further, at the micro level, of course, this is about the lowest level. So the village, the city, the region, maybe the region is already meso-ish, but certainly also the individual level, or the group, kind of the micro-sociology. How do perpetrators commit violence together? How do victims experience the victimization together? How do third parties intervene or not? Why did one village in the Rwandan genocide collaborate in the killings and another village didn't? So the most famous book is, of course, Christopher Browning's, again, Ordinary Men. But also, if you think of Scott Strauss's The Order of Genocide, a very influential book, there too, we look at perpetrators. Why do people commit killing? And one of our authors in the book, Shel Anderson, has a book forthcoming. I think it's called The Criminology of Genocide, which is a study of comparative study of perpetrators. And of course, that is ultimately what genocide is about. Also, it's about people visiting acts of violence upon their fellow human beings. So this is kind of these are the three contextual layers. And what I'm also interested in is the interaction between the three levels. Of course, this is, as a model, it sketches kind of the broad outlines. Now, the second dimension in this model is the temporal dimension, of course. And that's why we structured this book, new perspectives on its causes, courses, and consequences. So I think it's interesting to look at genocides before the actual mass killing, and during the mass killing, and then after the mass killing. And I think these three processes historically, we historicize them, we look at the chronological developments. They can be studied separately, they can also be studied holistically, but if you take seriously the complexity of each three of these processes, then it's quite startling. So take a process of crisis, for example. You know, if you look at Nazi Germany, I think from 1933 to 1939, that is in itself complex enough, and it deserves study by itself. And why society can polarize and can radicalize? Why is it that an extremist group like the Nazis, how is it that they can seize power? They can control the monopoly of violence. They can even marshal quite a lot of popular support from the German population. And that in itself, you know, think of Saul Friedlander's first volume.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's called Persecution, 1933 and 1939. And that's important enough to devote entire books to it itself. But of course, the transition into the actual genocidal phase is also serious enough. And that's where the actual killing happens. You know, how does that happen? Why does it transition? And ultimately, what happens after a genocide? You know, the field of transitional justice is a research field, and actually one of the pillars at NIOT as well, that deals exclusively with the aftermaths of post-conflict or post-war, post-genocide. There's been a lot of research in different societies, Rwanda, Yugoslavia, Cambodia. So if you look at these three dimensions, you can see how incredibly complex this is. You can look at the micro level before genocide. You can look at the macro level after genocide.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, of course, we don't want to pigeonhole research. You can certainly combine, but I think it can kind of help structuring a lot of research on genocide. And if you look at any library, you know, walk into a library with books on genocide, and you can clearly see that a lot of books, they focus on one of the aspects, either on the temporally before or during or after, or macro level or mm-hmm. micro level. So that's why we structured it this way, and I think it worked out, you know, pretty well with the contributions. I think they fit neatly into one of these categories.
Well, there's no way we can talk about each of these essays in the time we have available. But I would like to hit, I guess, a few specific essays and themes and essays that maybe embody some of the broader themes of the book. And I'd like to start by you mentioned, and I as we talked about before we actually formally started the interview, I'm going to apologize in advance because I'm not going to get the pronunciation completely right on some of these. But you pointed to, did you say Kjell? Is that how you pronounce Kjell and Anderson?
Kjell.
That is a criminologist. And that essay is really interesting. So I'm wondering if you could say something about what a criminologist brings to the study of genocide and maybe what that essay does that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, we must realize that the field of genocide studies is an eminently interdisciplinary research field. Or maybe we should say multidisciplinary.
Mm-hmm.
Historians who work on specific cases, there are sociologists who compare. There are anthropologists who use anthropological methods such as ethnography or interviews, and also of course criminologists, because, well, genocide is of course a crime,
mm-hmm.
and it's probably one of the worst crimes that you can think of, because when a state actually fails to protect its citizens, and it actually it deviates from the norm of using its state sovereignty to protect its citizens and to uphold its principles its principles of citizenship, and it starts killing its own citizens, then we're dealing with a divine state, with what Anderson calls in his essay the criminogenic state.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things there are actually two things that are interesting about that chapter. I mean, there are many things interesting about that chapter. Two things that I thought were particularly interesting is, first of all, what he calls in the conclusion, the paradox of state power. So, on the one hand, of course, states, and this is a relatively old claim as well, that also was made by Max Weber and by Charles Tilly. On the one hand, states, they monopolize power, and by monopolizing power, they pacify society, so interpersonal violence decreases. So you don't have to, if you have a problem with your neighbor, you don't have to get an AK-47 and go shoot him and, you know, and then get your lawnmower back. But you can just go to the state and the state can mediate. But at the same time, so, you know, while it monopolizes violence and while it pacifies society, states accumulate immense means of violence in barracks, of course, using soldiers. You know, states have immense stockpiles of weapons. And so, on the one hand, you need state power to bring an end to genocide, and you need states to function properly. But at the other hand, is state power itself that can be the cause of genocide. So the concentration of power, and concentration of, especially of the monopoly of violence, is necessary to enact genocides. So the question that Anderson asks in his chapter is, how can states be the instrument of human rights enforcement when they, just like individuals, are often self-interested or even selfish? So I think this is a dilemma that's as much a political dilemma as it is an academic dilemma. I think it's a scholarly dilemma. And, well, of course, the criminologists, they work with different kind of methods. This is my second point, in that they can understand and decipher what is often called legalese. Mm-hmm. So I am absolutely terrible at reading, let's say, you know, ICTY judgments or my kind of legal documents. I'm not trained enough for it. Maybe I should spend a little bit more time, maybe in the courthouses. But there's a kind of methodologies of understanding how legal processes function, and also how they create for themselves legal loopholes and no man's land really to commit mm-hmm. genocide. Remember, there's a famous saying that, I think it was by Rubinstein, the philosopher, that at Auschwitz there was not a single law that was broken.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important to focus on the law. At the same time, you also have criminologists who do interviews with perpetrators, for example. It's also part of Anderson's research. And I think it brings a lot of kind of depth and richness to the to the book, to bring in different disciplines. And I think a lot of people actually have different backgrounds in terms of their discipline.
Yeah, that's a high point to the book. And I have to say, I will be interested. I'm glad to hear you say that there's a book coming, whether it's coming out of this essay or not. Having just interviewed Timothy Snyder a couple months ago for the podcast, and hear him talk about how that it is exactly in places which are stateless where victims are most at risk. I would be really curious to see this. I will watch this dialogue unfold between the criminologist and the historian. But
mm-hmm.
The second part of the book is titled Courses of Genocide. And here there's a really interesting essay that I don't think would appear in many genocide studies compilations. And it's an essay by Alex, I believe Alex de Jong. About the Filipino communist guerrilla movement. Can you say something about what this essay is about and why you thought that was an important contribution in genocide studies?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people wouldn't think that the ebb and flow of Filipino communism in the 1980s that really merits to be discussed and examined under the nomenclature of genocide. But what is interesting about Alex's research is, and especially in this chapter, is how he, by examining sources that are otherwise not that easily accessible, he manages to step into the shoes, or maybe to crawl into the minds of a very radical extremist group of communists in the Philippines in the 1980s, and how this group of men, and sometimes women, how they imagined that the world looked. So what kind of fantasies did they have? What was their worldview? And how did they believe that violence was the way to make the world conform to those fantasies and to those radical ideologies? So instead of changing their minds, instead of adapting the extreme ideology to the realities on the ground, they actually tried to do it the other way around. So they tried to change realities on the ground to fit and to conform to the extreme ideology. And why is this important? Because, well, genocides are launched, of course, by political elites who have the will and the ruthlessness to pursue and to launch a process of mass killing, mass murder. And so the only way to really, really, really understand why genocides are launched is to examine those political elites, those radical political elites, who launch a genocidal process. So whether that is, let's say, Stalin's inner circle, or whether that's the SS elite, or what is often called the Akazu, the small house in Rwanda, although there's a lot of criticism on that as well, it is important to examine why political elites think what they think and how they act upon those beliefs. So what you see here in these Filipino communists is that obviously they had a vision for Filipino society. If it was up to them, if they ever seized power, they probably would have killed a great number of people thinking that they were either bourgeoisie or they were traitors or they were not the right kind of workers. The intellectuals, so much like the Khmer Rouge did in Cambodia. But what is interesting is that this violence, and maybe this is kind of unique for communism, for extreme communism, this violence is not only outward looking, it's not only outward, not only directed outward, but also inward. So you see purges of fellow party members, so of comrades, really. And it's interesting to examine why that's the case, because we have also seen that that kind of violence, kind of inward-looking purges, mass killings of fellow party members, also occurred, of course, under Stalinism in the Soviet Union. I think it's relevant because very often it is after a purge, or maybe sometimes before a purge, that that a process of genocide, a process of mass murder, is unleashed upon a society. And we saw this also here. The two biggest concepts, the two most important concepts in the Filipino communist movement, was on the one hand infiltration. Of course, and the second important concept was probably treason. So the elites, they were obsessed with these two concepts of treason and infiltration. So if the ideology didn't work, if the peasants rejected their ideas about land distribution or about confiscation, then that was treason. You had to be executed. And if, for example, if one of the fellow comrades, if he didn't agree with a policy, then he was an infiltrator, and he needed to be executed, just to make reality ideologically consistent again.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I'm still puzzled by this. Interestingly, I'm still sometimes when I reread the chapter, I think, why are these people killing each other? These are your comrades. You're supposed to, for whatever it's worth, this kind of murderous purges are so counterproductive to your ideology and to your movement. I don't really get it. And until, of course, this was last winter, when in a completely different context, I had a conversation with Alex about ISIS and about ISIS, Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, when it loses territory. So rather than accepting the fact that they lost a battle or that they had to cede land or that they had to retreat, they blame it very often. The organization blames it on the commander, or blames it on infiltrators, or on treason, and actually executes a whole bunch of its own members. And that actually happens. So in the past couple of months, it doesn't appear very often in the news, because they don't propagate that, of course.
Yeah.
They don't want to lose their recruitment levels. But ISIS has obscene levels of inward violence that they use. So it is just as easy for an atheist or for a Yazidi to be killed than for an ISIS member who is critical, for example, or who doesn't conform fully to the extremely radical ideology, or somebody who smokes, or for somebody who has a sexual relation outside of marriage. So we must also be sensitive to the violence that is directed inwards of these extreme organizations, because very often it's a model for what they will be doing when they seize power.
So, and we don't have a lot of time to talk about this essay, but I'll just comment. I thought as well the essay by I believe Franziska Karpinski and Lucia Ravinsky on sexual violence in the Nazi genocide was also very good. And it adds to what I think is a newfound interest in concentration on gender in genocide studies. Mm-hmm. But the third part addresses the consequences of genocide. And rather than go through each essay individually, I wonder if you could say something about, maybe briefly talk about the subject of these essays, and then maybe say something about the broad lessons or themes that emerge from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we have, the book has three essays in its in the section on the consequences of genocide, or maybe we should say the aftermath of genocide.
There's
one chapter about by Laura Burhout, which is on Sarajevo and how in that war-torn city in the post-war landscape of memory, how Serbs and Muslims and Croats, how they compete for attention in the public space, how they compete, and also very often they make mutually exclusive claims on the history of the war. Yeah, so you'll have a Serb memorial which will say something completely different from a Croat memorial or from a mm-hmm. from a Bosnian Muslim, a Bosniak memorial. And that seeps also into the education, of course. Bosnia is a very divided society in which Serb children are learning things that are completely different from Bosnian children. And that is really, really painful, of course, because we know that social segregation is not a very helpful development in fostering reconciliation or even just basic coexistence. I mean, we know that from non-genocidal peaceful states just as much as from post-genocidal states. So I think that every passing day that these children, they're educated in completely different curricula, people, they use their own discourse and they watch their own television channels and they read their own newspapers, the less people get together, the worse that looks for the immediate future, but especially for the long-term future of Bosnia. And so that was a rather pessimistic chapter by Burhout. Even though, of course, there are initiatives, small, but there are initiatives to bring people together. Then there's a chapter by Suzanne Hoeksema, which is about re-educating Rwandan genocide perpetrators in the so-called Ingando camps. Mm-hmm. Ingando means it means re-education. And it is when the Kagame government, after the genocide, when they had so many perpetrators, didn't know what to do with them. Of course, they put them in prison, and some of them were enrolled in re-education camps where they had to unlearn basically anything they had learned in the Habyarimana years and also during the genocide, and they had to conform to the new ideology in Rwanda, which is Rwandanness and submission to the Kagame regime. And what is interesting there is that, well, you might think this is a very laudable initiative, but of course what happens in these camps is that people are indoctrinated with a relatively authoritarian ideology. Right? They have to sing songs, and they cannot use the term Hutu and Tutsi anymore. But it's so unrealistic, as if people don't remember what happened 20 years ago. So it's really difficult to purify the public discourse from these terms, of course. So on the other hand, there have also been some elements that have helped ex-prisoners to reintegrate into their communities, right? So whether they really believe it, whether they're really convinced, that will be really difficult to say. And of course, the objective is laudable, it's national unity and reconciliation. But of course, these rules are very strictly controlled by the Rwandan government. And so it's not really, in Gando, it really doesn't function as a as a kind of open space or free open space mm-hmm. to express your thoughts. No, it's a very clear indoctrination regime, of course. And then the final chapter is by Thijs Bouwknecht, who also works at the New York right now, and which is it's really a comparative a study of transitional justice in Rwanda and Sierra Leone. He kind of looks at how fact-finding or how history is established through trials, but also outside of trials. So how do people really reconstruct? What is the influence of transitional justice mechanisms on establishing the historical record. Now, on the one hand, you have historians, of course, who will say, well, I'm not interested in what the tribunals have to say, and what the courts have to say. I'll just ignore it, and I'll just go straight to the sources, right? And on the other hand, you have historians who are who have a different position, right? Who will say, well, actually, it's very important that people accept a truth that is acceptable to all of them, and that we are open for different interpretations of truth. But of course, this also leads to issues of distortion, of maybe extreme postmodernism, in that, well, you have your truth and I have my truth, and let's move on now. But of course, that's a little bit too subjectivist for many other historians, including also for myself. And it's a very rich chapter that builds upon a broad area of sources from the Rwandan Tribunal, as well as from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for Sierra Leone, because they do produce a lot of sources, of course.
Mm-hmm.
For those people who are really interested, of course, they should get the book and read the whole thing.
Indeed. And the all of the essays are good, but these three in particular caught my eye. And I may actually be sending my students to the book the next time I teach comparative genocide. I noticed some of the authors here moved on to further education or to teach. Some of them have taken up other careers. What kind of career paths do your students take after they're done?
Well, we have we're actually in the process of doing some research on that right now. But our our graduates, our alumni, we have a pretty good alumni association. They end up in different jobs, really. Some of them, of course, they want to work in the tribunals, for example, right? Whether it's the ICC or the Yugoslavia Tribunal or the various international legal courts, the international courts in The Hague. That is generally very difficult, of course, because you need to have a legal background for that. Not that many of our students have it. Now others move on. They work for NGOs, like human rights NGOs and documentation NGOs. We had an excellent student who went to Rwanda and worked with the media office. Then others become active in journalism and in other forms of research. And then there's a small minority, of course, as you know, it's quite difficult to acquire a PhD position. And some of them pursue their research and they do PhDs. And there are one or two of the authors of this book who managed to pursue their research into postgraduate research, and which has been quite effective. And because the foundation was already there, right? And these chapters were the MA thesis, and if you have part of your MA thesis published, you have a very strong hand when you apply for a PhD position, of course.
Yeah.
And I could recommend all master's students to do their best on their theses, because your thesis really is your business card, especially if you can manage to get it published. That would be fantastic, and always make sure that you mention that and put it on your CV pontifically.
Well, you've been very generous with your time, and it's about time to wrap up. But I always ask guests at the end to offer suggestions, a book or two, or a movie, or both, things they watched or read that were meaningful to them. It might be a new book that you're currently reading. It might be something older. What should our listeners watch or read this weekend?
There's, of course, there's a whole range of excellent academic books out there, but I think sometimes as academics we can suffer sometimes from blinkers. So we only read academic books, and we think that we don't need to reach out to other forms of to other writings, whether it's literature or there's the world of art, etc. And to be honest, I used to think that as well. I thought the truth is in the academic books, and I don't have to read anything else. But I think that's wrong. I think actually art and literature has to pick up where we reach the boundaries of academic research. And I think especially two pieces of art really caught my attention. One is a very famous historical novel by Vasily Grossman called Life and Fate. And, well, if you can finish it in the weekend, then that's great. But it's a really, really thick book. It's 1,000 pages. It's a wonderful historical novel, almost Tolstoy-esque, which deals with the Second World War. So Vasily Grossman was a Soviet Jewish journalist who traveled to the front, to the Soviet German front, from the mid 1940s on, and he wrote a beautiful epic story about different families and their different storylines in the book. And it just kind of, the book grabs you in the first page and doesn't let you go onto the last one. And I could totally recommend that. It's a very, very touching book, very sensitively written. It's really important because Vasily Grossman in that book, he makes an effort to describe what it must have looked like, what it must have felt like inside of a gas chamber.
Mm.
And we don't have any academic books because we don't have any sources of people who escaped from it. So we have to use our fantasy, or we have to use our artistic imagination. And Grossman has done a very admirable and especially very dignified and humble job in depicting that scene. But the whole thing is just riveting, and it's just on a human level, it confronts you with how much suffering there was in the Second World War on that front. And then, speaking of suffering, I'm also a big fan of documentaries. We show a lot of documentaries to our students as well. I really think that in the past 10 years, maybe even the best documentary I've ever seen, are the two documentaries by Joshua Oppenheimer. So The Act of Killing, the first one, and the second one was called The Look of Silence. And this is a documentary. The Act of Killing was about Indonesian genocide perpetrators of 1965, 1966. So these men are now all in their 60s, 70s, 80s. And they're just roaming around free, and they're very proud and very happy about how many people they killed, how many communists, or alleged communists and Chinese people they killed in 1965, 66. And Oppenheimer manages to gain the trust of one of these guys. And it's a really affable, really sweet, jovial guy, and he's in his 70s, I guess. And he's got grandchildren, and he's wearing these batik shirts, or he's Indonesian, really. It's like an Indonesian Hawaiian shirt. And he dances around, but then he says, well, this is the roof where I killed like 1,000 people. And he shows it, and he describes it in extremely graphic, and what is so baffling, utterly, utterly flabbergasted by this documentary, is the complete impunity and the shamelessness that these people talk about their achievements. Their genocide is an achievement. And I think that's the first time maybe ever where we got a clear view of what happens to a society, so the consequences. What happens to a society when there's impunity and when there's no transitional justice after a genocide? Well, what happens is all of the perpetrators, they seize key positions, and they run their society, and they kind of terrorize the survivors and the family members of the victims. And the second documentary is also very good. It kind of touches upon the same subject. It talks to perpetrators, older, really elderly men, who describe and who enact their killings, because Oppenheimer asks them to play it out, to show how they did it. But it also talks to some victims or to some survivors of that genocide. Deeply, deeply touching, extremely profound, and I think everybody should see it, not just people who are interested in genocide. I think everybody must watch these two documentaries.
Yeah, I've seen The Act of Killing, and it's wonderful, and I will have to put its successor, I guess, I don't know that it's a sequel, but it's successor on my list. Maybe not for this weekend, because at least here in the States, this is almost final exam time. So the grading piles are somewhat intimidating, but not quite as big as Vasily Grossman, but also an excellent book. So I always conclude with one last question. And you're done with this. I don't know how long it's been out in Europe and in the States. Amazon tells me it will be out by the time this interview goes live. What are you working on now?
I'm currently involved in a relatively large research project that deals with paramilitaries. So in this project, in which I'm the principal investigator, there are two PhD candidates, and the project deals with paramilitary violence. It focuses especially on the conflicts in the 1990s in Yugoslavia and in Turkey. So one PhD candidate works on Serb paramilitaries in Yugoslavia, and the second PhD candidate works on Turkish paramilitaries in the Kurdish areas in the 1990s. And the focus or the kind of the angle of this project is to examine how paramilitary groups, how they emerge, how they function, and how they disappear. So for states that actually can resort to the vast apparatus of violence, as we've just, as I just argued, what if it has an army and it has a police and a gendarmerie? Why does it feel the need to establish paramilitary groups, especially in moments, periods of crises such as civil wars? And how does that relate to the commission of mass atrocities and mass violence? Because most genocides and most mass atrocities are committed not necessarily by police or by army, but by special paramilitary groups. And this is what we're, the kind of perpetrator research that we're doing right now. And this research also collaborates with a colleague from Utrecht University. Her name is Suzanne Knittel. And we set up the Perpetrator Studies Network. And you can find it on Facebook as well as on, if you Google it. And we try to advance research on perpetrators, which is tough, but it's very rewarding and very important, I think.
That sounds like a fascinating project. And I hope when you're done, you'll come back on New Books in Genocide Studies and talk to us about it. But until then, thank you so much again for doing the interview.
Thank you for having me, and good luck.
You've been listening to an interview with Uğur Ümit Ungor, the editor of Genocide, New Book Perspectives on Its Causes, Courses, and Consequences. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of Podcasts. I hope you'll join me next time when I begin an occasional series of podcasts that addresses the question of how genocides end and how they might be prevented or mitigated. Later in the summer, I'll interview James Waller and Bridget Conley Zilkich. But we'll kick off the series with Scott Straus, who makes a return appearance on the podcast to discuss his new work, Fundamentals of Genocide and Mass Atrocity Prevention. I hope you'll come back to hear these interviews. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.